Godspeed with Carol Hollenbeck, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom. In an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbeck. Ashok Gangadin is professor of philosophy at Haverford College, where he has taught for the past 43 years. He is founder and director of the Global Dialogue Institute and co-convener of the World Commission on Global Consciousness and Spirituality. His books include Meditations on Global First Philosophy, Quest for the Missing Grammar of Logos, Meditative Reason Toward Universal Grammar, and more. Dr. Gangadin, welcome to the Institute, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much, Carol. It's a pleasure to come in from Seattle here. My home base is usually Philadelphia, but my daughter just graduated from the university yesterday, and I'm here in Seattle, and a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, thank you, and congratulations to your daughter and your family.
Thank you.
Now, of course, global consciousness, of course, is a rather large issue, some might say a rather intangible one, but at the same time, feels like it's in the back of all our minds, almost like a soundtrack that, you know we have to move toward somehow. As a beginning place, can you share a little bit about global consciousness, just as a foundation, what it means to you? And please take your time. You have the floor.
Thank you so much, Carol. And please call me Ashok. I, you know, in terms of my journey as a philosopher, I'm trained in logic in the Western tradition. I didn't know any Eastern thought, even though my family originated in India. I was born in Trinidad in the West Indies and grew up 5 years there, in the Jamaica, then New York City. So I grew up in New York City. And although we had a Hindu background, it was a cultural background. I was raised in a Christian setting. So I was always between worlds in who I am and how do I center my primary script of life. And so that was the journey. But I went into philosophy because I was deeply called, because I felt deep in my consciousness, even as a boy, before I knew philosophy, that there is a universal light. There's something universal. I didn't call it global then, and I went into logic because in the early 60s, if you're going to focus on philosophy in the United States, as I was, it was dominated by analytic philosophy, logic, coming out of the great breakthrough of mathematical logic with Frege, Russell, Wittgenstein, and these illustrious names, Lord Russell from Cambridge. So I went into logic because I wanted to get the tools and skills to know what the heart of being a philosopher. And philosophy, as you may know, means lover of Sophia. Sophia, the infinite feminine, represents embodied wisdom, and a lover of wisdom is a philosophia. And so that was what was calling me. And these threads would get woven together over decades of work. So logic is the attempt to decode the nature of thought and consciousness and language, to get the laws of thought. That's logic. So if you could really get that, it's almost comparable to decoding the DNA, the structure of life. So logic is trying to get the ultimate code, the grammar of consciousness, of making sense of the world, and that's where our world or worldview is shaped. Most of us aren't educated to know that when you enter a culture and are brought into it, from the earliest, we're entering a worldview that has a certain grammar and shapes the lens of the mind. And everything we see in our world, or interpreting ourselves, our own stories, our family, everything in our experience is done through that cultural lens. We're not educated often to see that I have a lens. And when you cross cultures, you're really doing something dramatic and amazing. You're going into a different lens structure, a different lens of the mind, a different way of processing reality. So if you're raised in the Judeo-Christian world, let's say, and you see the world that way, and of course an everyday American person is living among through many worlds. You may be living in the biblical world in one respect, and God created the universe, and you hope we'll go with Godspeed, I love the name of your show, and your institute, And then you may be a physicist, and you know that the Big Bang must be true, and you're speaking a different language, a different grammar of consciousness. And what you see from the Big Bang lens is very different from what you see from the biblical lens, where infinite spirit creates the universe, and you are part of that story of the creation. That's a different you. And you could be a civic American, and you realize that I believe in the amazing breakthrough of democracy and civic culture and the ecumenical importance of separation of religion and politics and state and the church and state and so forth. And that hurts because your religion is saying love God with everything you've got in every moment, in every breath. So the theme I'm trying to just elaborate for you about global consciousness is global consciousness is an amazing advance in our human journey. It is that given that human beings are naturally inclined to get a more tribal lens, a more local culture, or even a disciplinary base, whatever it is, the lens of the mind of your world is shaped. You see everything through that lens. We sometimes have often have multiple lenses, and we don't know the skills and techniques and capacities to dance competently across lenses. If I'm a Christian and I see that Jesus is the truth and God is infinite and that is the language I speak, can I enter the Hindu world? Can I truly cross into the space of samsara and karma and dharma and prana and yoga and enter the Bhagavad Gita and understand that script in its own terms and not to impose it through my lens?
Right.
Of the truth I know. So if we have a lens and we are more localized, global consciousness, your question, I'm trying to just get the background launched. Global consciousness is the evolution of our consciousness with the capacity to dance authentically across multiple lenses and worlds and scriptures and disciplines without getting broken, without getting fragmented into different local identities and multiple personalities. And that takes a certain skills of dialogue. I must be able to dialogue across worlds. And so the word dialogue is very important for global consciousness, and is often misunderstood. Dialogue means dialogos, through the logos. And the logos in the Greek tradition is the infinite word, the infinite speech and mind and reason, and all of those deep words out of which logic comes, from the logos and science. And dialogos means through the logos. So if I'm having my Christian voice, and I have my American civic voice, and I have
right.
my scientific voice, how do I connect those authentically without being fragmented? So global consciousness, to sum up, is an amazing evolutionary advance for humans as global citizens in a global age to really dilate our minds and to develop the capacity to hold multiple worlds and lenses together in one integral awareness. And that's really what global consciousness moves into.
Thank you so much for that answer. And it's fascinating, too. There's so much grist in there to be working with when we think of our lens, even neighbors beside each other with the same background or living in New York City or the culture or a Judeo-Christian background will still even have different lenses that
they bring
to it based on family, based on economy, based on so many things that the lens is almost singular, sort of like 7 billion people, 7 billion different lenses almost.
That's quite right, Carol. And, that's why if you just look at the evolution of Christian the traditions and the vast diversity of sectarian divisions and the shift from the Catholic to the Protestant and the Protestant
yeah.
to the Quaker. I'm teaching in a Quaker institution here at Haverford College, founded by the Quakers, and the Quakers were trying to, in effect, open up the global power of Christianity and to move that Reformation and the founding of America in Philadelphia with the Quaker influence of the quest for religious freedom was also attempting. So what I'm calling global consciousness is actually not new. The emergence of it in our cultures on a planetary basis is new and unprecedented in our global age, in a global
yes.
village. But it's old. It's classic. Jesus was opening up global script. And
yes.
Krishna in the yoga is opening up global yoga.
Yes.
And Buddha is opening up the global Buddha Dharma. and Lao Tzu is. So when you look at our great elders across the planet, they were all attempting to help humanity emerge and grow into a global consciousness, a global capacity to be a human.
Now, if it's so, you know, intrinsic to us, it seems to be, and it keeps coming up over and over again, is there, do you believe, a destiny for human beings? Are we meant, do we need all these reminders because we're on a journey and that we're meant to evolve to something in particular?
Well, that's a great question, but I'd be cautious about the word destiny because it can sound destined and predestined in a way that we would ordinarily hear it. What I think is important, what I discovered painfully over decades of work, is that our great teachers were showing us that humans have been lodged in an ego-based way of thinking and scripting and lensing. And that's been the problem of fragmentation and dysfunction in our human lives, individually, interpersonally, and interculturally across the planet. The human metaphysical or ontological disturbance or suffering, as Buddha would call it, traces back to the lens that you're using. If you're using a fragmenting lens, an ego-based, an ego-mental, a monocentric lens, in contrast to an awakened lens, which is dialogic and holistic and integral, and that's what I'm calling the global lens, that's really the main point. So when you say destined, predetermined in the ego-based way of thinking is not the same as our human destiny as evolutionary beings. So
right.
The way I would put it then is, if there is an infinite logos, whether you call it Tao, Yahweh, Allah, you know, Christ, Buddha, whatever name you use for the infinite force, and it has infinite possibilities, if everything comes out of that, then everything in creation is implanted and encoded with that fractal power to reflect
yes.
that infinite force. That's where the destiny comes from. So we humans are encoded to awaken to our logos origin. And that is the human evolutionary journey and drama that we are in and in the midst of. That's so exciting.
Yes, it is. Now, you mentioned the word fragmentation several times, and I'd just like to ask you, what are the kinds of challenges or problems or even suffering that may come out of our fragmentation or our fragmented point of view through our lens?
Well, a great question. And what are our teachers... And when I say that, I'm just opening up the board. I see Abraham's struggle and the Abraham-Isaac drama as one version
yeah.
of it. Moses getting the laws and speaking to God and God replying to him, I am that I am. But Jesus and all of the powerful teaching of Jesus when he speaks, I am the way, and speaking this higher script to his disciples. And they were at first not getting it. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, who is the broken down warrior, and teaching him the script of yoga. All of these, they're all teaching this way to move to this higher integral script. And what they see, and this is the main point, Carol, they all in very different ways see that if you're in the ego script, the ego lens, you are cut off from the logos, you're cut off from the higher infinite field. And that is what caused that disconnect, is deep and profound and all-pervasive. To be cut off from the flow, an athlete would say, being in the zone, when you're in the zone, you're in that yoga state. When you're cut off from that, it's so deep, it's called in the biblical sin. Sin is the cut of your mind and your lens and your being from integral connectivity with the infinite force and presence, which is ever-present. In Eastern thought, it's called samsara. Samsara is the fall and disconnect from the Om space, the Buddha space, the Tao space, the Qi energy. When those circuits get broken, and you use that I use single brackets to mark as a logician, and it may be helpful in our conversation. Imagine single strokes, like just two strokes to surround every word, like a quotation mark, an ego quote. To remind you, you're using the broken lens. And I use double parentheses, curve,
yeah.
to remind us when we're in the integral Christ, Buddha, Krishna script. That's the global script. This is important because every word we use, Carol, can be coded out in the single bracket, ego mental space, or C seen in the double parentheses integral holistic meaning. And so fragmentation is the name of the game. And your question is great, because Buddha saw that when he says existence is suffering, he meant that ego lives are cut off from the Buddha field. And when that happens, everything you touch is broken. Everything becomes an object. You objectify it. You objectify yourself. You objectify others. You objectify every item in your world. You call it a being. You call it an entity. And you don't realize that when you're doing that, you're breaking it off from its fractal, infinite flow of interconnectivity as an energetic event woven into the fabric that Buddha was trying to help humanity stop that. So the suffering is in every direction of your life, because your life is dominated by your lens. If you're in a sin lens, that's why Jesus says the wage of sin is death, because sin is a very deep and profound force to be cut off. And the wage to overcome sin, which is salvation, the journey in that language, is to be reunited with God, to come into grace through Christ, and to flow in that Christ energy. But Buddha is teaching that same journey, to go into the Buddha space, which he calls emptiness or shunyata. He didn't want to use the old vocabulary, so he cleansed it all and said, call reality emptiness. And that's where infinite overflow of abundance and compassion, and that's where ethics comes to life, an enlightened, awakened life. That's where yoga is in the Om space. So your question about fragmentation and polarization is, if the lens we're using, the mind operating process, is one that is in sin or samsara, I call it sinsara, just to join those two. And if that's true, then our teachers are saying, if you're living in that lens, everything is going to be busted. You can't love yourself. You're going to be fragmented, polarized, multiple personalities, shifting moods. So that polar disorder, your relationship, male and female, let's say, that's why we say women from Venus, men are from Mars. They're speaking different ways. They're seeing it differently. They can't communicate. If you're talking about this communication in the workplace, it's going to be all you, each person has his or own agenda. As you pointed out, everyone has their own particular lens. And therefore, there's going to be grotesque miscommunication. Yeah. And if you take it into democracy, into the civic space, and we the people hold the power, ostensibly, but we can't be we. You're going to get profound breaks and fractures in the political space, and showdowns over power vote. You get the picture. You know, it's everywhere.
Well, yeah, because if you take this lens to a much larger level, and it's, you know, entire cultures or nations with a particular lens objectifying other people or things, objectifying food or oil, or you see where it goes.
Absolutely. That's where 9/11, Holocaust, genocides, on and on, but grotesque violence comes from that kind of monocentric lens, in contrast to a dialogic I-thou lens. You know, and Buddha says there are two ways of being. You can have an I-it, and the other is an it, an object. And then there's the I-thou, where the other is a presence, a sacred presence, and that's where you meet. We are I-thou beings, but we're using an I-it script. And that's tragic. And that really is the source of all kinds of violence and breakdowns and dysfunctions in human life.
Wow, that's so well said. I'm speechless for a moment. Thank you. The I-it versus the I-thou. Yes, the basic reverence and understanding of things is gone in that mental fragmentation.
That's right.
Including the value of even ourselves.
Especially that too, yes. You can't love yourself. So when Buddha saw that when you are in the Buddha space and Buddha script and Buddha lens of interconnected flow, and you're not longer making yourself an object, an it, then you begin to feel the presence of the other within you. You're different, but you're one. That's the I-thou. You meet in a possibility of a deep compassion and communion in your diversity and alterity, to use a technical word. Alterity means difference. The other is different, but not different in the single bracket ego way as an it, but as an other presence that's sacred. And our great poets and artists got that when Blake said, there's infinity in a grain of sand and eternity in an hour. He was speaking this high script. And if we could only understand when Quakers say there's that of God in every man, That's huge. That's classic. It's what Buddha and Krishna and all the great wisdom teachers are pointing out. When you enter into this script, the integral script, it's an amazing shift into sacred life. Everything is sacred now because it is of the Logos. It's of Sophia. Every flower, every grain of sand, every human being, every creature, nature is sacred. Imagine if people could, and that's global consciousness. Global consciousness is an awakened, enlightened awareness of sensitivity, of being in the zone, and feeling and cherishing the sacred interconnectivity of all that, because it's the body of Logos. It's the body of God. And that's where Godspeed leads, I think.
Thank you very much, for that answer. Let's speak briefly, if we can. Could you share about the World Commission on Global Consciousness and Spirituality?
Of course. Your
organization, where it was formed, and who are some of its co-chairs, et cetera?
Well, yes, just to give you the background of that. As an academic philosopher, I encountered a lot of dissonance as I began to clarify this critique of ego-based culture, which I think dominates our cultures now as ever. We're still, despite all of the wisdom and spirituality that we allege to have in the world, we are still dominated in our cultures and personal lives by this single bracket lens, the mono lens, and the great technological shift. We can pick up that in a moment. That so many different wisdom teachers are saying we're in a deep shift, and the shift is the shift in consciousness, in the mind, and I would say in the script. That's a technological advance of the highest order that these teachers are calling for all this time. So I saw in the academy that we're still living under the dominance of that, despite the wisdom, and so I felt moved to form an institute called Global Dialogue Institute to develop capacities to do dialogue across worldviews. That seemed to me to be vital. So not monologue, not people speaking to others from their single lens and seeing them
through,
but dialogue. And from that, it became clear that there were a number of eminent voices on the planet, all scattered, that needed to be brought together into some kind of institute, or I don't like the word think tank, but an activist force to mobilize the attempt to do our best to help the planet get uplifted to global consciousness and global dialogue. So I formed with some other partners, like Ewart Cousins, a theologian, and Robert Mueller from the UN, he passed away recently, he was a co-chair, with Karan Singh from India, who is an eminent voice in trying to bring religions together in interfaith dialogue. He's a pioneer, and they're very eminent in India, Karan Singh. And then I brought on Irvin Laszlo, who as a holistic integral scientist in his own way saw that we had to develop this new consciousness to face the urgent crises on the planet. So in that spirit, I brought them on, and I was a primary convener in bringing together some of the eminent voices who each in their own way, him and her, saw the importance of shifting consciousness and to know that something is afoot on the planet, but we need to somehow help facilitate it. And that's really what the World Commission on Global Consciousness was born in 1998 at the World Congress of Philosophy in Boston. It was meeting in Boston. And we worked with people like Robert Thurman, who was the right-hand person to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and a number of people like the Dalai Lama, Desmond Tutu, Wangari Maathai, who a few years later would get the Nobel Prize out of Kenya, and people like Du Wei Ming from China, who understood the Confucian wisdom, an eminent voice from Harvard, and Cornel West, an eminent African-American wisdom keeper out of Princeton and Harvard, was brought on. And on, about 20, 25 voices like that, men and women, Barbara Marx Hubbard, was brought on for her work on conscious evolution, and so on. And the whole point was, with all of our diversity, these diverse eminent voices all concurred that we have to help bring a shift in consciousness in how we conduct our lives if we're going to get to the root of the crises facing humanity today. They began to see, that the crises in the planet trace to our consciousness. And the world.
Well,
go ahead, Carol.
Ashok, I completely relate to what you're bringing up and experienced in my own years within ecumenical events that I started calling it, you know, alone together.
Mm-hmm.
That there was an I, you, or I, it way of sharing that seemed also to involve people speaking to affect others or to change others. And there also came a kind of washing away of the language of God in an attempt to be, I guess, more universal.
Yes.
But I find that that's not really the trend. I mean, this is my experience just from, you know, my years and my work and our program, that the trend is not to wash away everyone's differences to some sort of common, you know, idea or concept of God or religion, but that rather there is other and that people are invited to bring their selves to the table and in bright colors and fully dressed, you know, whatever makes them unique and special in their own, you know, spiritual lens. What would you say of your experience of that?
Well, that's wonderful to share that, Carol. I mean, I see it analogously, and I think that there are two models working for that kind of conversation. If you can go into the global space, the global lens, the Christ space, the Buddha space, the yoga space, the Om, the Tao space, again, I keep repeating it, and let's call it the Logos sphere, or the Sophia sphere. I use the word Logos Sophia for that field, just to take the font of the Greek wisdom as a candidate to just hold that high space. The consensus across the planet is that everything is deeply interconnected and flowing in the fundamental field of reality. And we need a lens and a script and intelligence and capacities to surf that. That's where we grow up as humans. And that's our evolutionary journey. And that's really what awakened moral consciousness is.
Mm.
So this is really your remark in terms of your journey. Diversity is sacred. Otherness, difference, is sacred in this double bracket space. Why? Because the infinite is not single bracket. It's not. God is global. God is infinite. The infinite is global. The global is holistic. The holistic is fractal. It's boundless. It's filled with infinite diversity. The unity is filled with diversity. That's the consensus of the deepest quest for reality. What does that mean? It means each of us is absolutely sacred and unique in the universe. Each of us holds a unique space in that infinite field of diversity, which is held together in the deep interconnectivity of that unity. So if you're speaking the high script, the double bracket unity, it's filled with diversity, sacred diversity. When you come to that table, and let's just think of America as a multicultural nation in the civic space, if we could reach that America that Martin Luther King said, I've been there, I've been to the other side, I've seen at the mountaintop what we can be, that double bracket civic space, we the people, that is down the penny, the e pluribus unum, out of the many one. But that one is not a single bracket one, which is dangerous because that can become tyrannical. A single bracket unity squelches diversity. It melts it down into the melting pot. It can't deal with difference. So the double bracket unity is a holistic one. The Buddhists call it Indra's net. Reality is Indra's net. It's an infinite holistic field with infinite points, each a jewel, and yet each point encodes the entire whole within it. That's a grain of sand or the mustard seed point. And each of us is a grain of human. We encode the entire field within our space. If we could have a dialogue like that, if we could have an America, a civic space, where we could show up and shine in our colors, as you put it, and be deeper than we imagined, because if we imagine ourselves as a single bracket it, that difference is not a difference. That could be pathological. That could be divisive. But if we could see the deeper diversity and sacredness of our diversity in unity, then we can show up for the dance of dialogue.
Thank you, Ashok. We're about halfway through the program now, and we'll take a station ID. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. We're going to take a short break. After the break, we'll continue our conversation on global consciousness and logos with Ashok
Gangadin. Here's a little song from the 70s you might recall. Stay with us.
Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking. Time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, oh, oh. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, girl, just you and me.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. That was Harold Melvin in the Blue Notes, showing us how consciousness can be very, very cool. We're talking with Dr. Ashok Gangadin, author and professor of philosophy at Haverford College. Now, Ashok, in this part of the program, I'd like to focus a little more on the logos component of your work and the grammar. It's terribly important, as we know, and it can also, as we know from history, be so divisive as well. The words we use, very, very powerful. They can divide and they can unite. It's interesting to me, for example, in the four Gospels in the New Testament, the four different writers telling the story of Jesus almost as though four different witnesses of a car accident, and each has his own view, and details, different details emerge and are important to the different people and the words they use. And in fact, I think it's the Gospel of John that refers specifically to the Word or Logos, and associating it so closely with God and origin and creation. Let's delve a little deeper now into your work regarding this grammar and the search for grammar. Would you share on that?
Yes, thank you. You set the point up very well there, Carol. I love John when he began in the beginning of the Logos, and the Logos was God, and the Logos spoke, and Jesus is seen as the Logos in the flesh. And that's really when the confluence of two different strands, culturally, the Judaic language, the Hebraic language, meets the Hellenistic or Greek, and the word logos, which is so prime in that tradition, the Greek tradition, is the birth of philosophy and reason and rational consciousness coming out of the logos word, which means the origin of the light of the mind, of speech. So it gets down to speech and script. And so the logos, when I use the word logos in this higher double bracket sense, not in the ego box where most of it, whenever we talk, one of the main points coming out of our earlier conversation in the prior session, one, is that if our speech is ego-based, we're going to put it on the screen in the box and write about it. But if you can go into the double parentheses awakened script, the great teachers knew that if you can handle the God script, the Om script, the Tao script, the Buddha script, the Christ script, whatever you call it, it's an infinite script. Why call it a script? That's very strange to our ears, because everyday people think, look, a script is a sign you write on the board or write on the paper or write on the computer. It's on the screen. And if you write the word red in English is a word for something out in the world that it points to. And if you say rain is falling, that's a sentence. If you say il pleut in French or es regnet in German, those are sentences that refers to a fact out in the world. That's how everyday script works. So script is representational. It's a picture of something that it represents. That's a normal, usual way of learning script and language. So when you say in the beginning is a word, that's very strange, because how can the word, a word is just a word. It's something you can utter. It's something you can write. But that's not the word in the high script. What you find when you cross into this awakened space, out of the cave, so to speak, and not looking at the walls of the cave, but into the light, you realize that the infinite presence, call it God, call it Yahweh, call it Allah, is the infinite script, infinite word. But that word is so pregnant with everything that the, every possibility of all the universes, all particularities, all phenomena, anything that can appear is an emanation out of that word. And it's manifested from that word. So in that case, if Jesus is the Logos in the flesh, he is a living word. He's scripture alive in living form. Buddha got that too. Buddha saw that you can't write it on paper. You've got to walk the talk. You've got to be the script. So the consensus of a great world wisdom is that there's a depth of script. When we evolve and awaken and come out of the cage, we realize we are scriptive beings. We are the script we've been waiting for. And that's what the science of the grammar, as you usually use it, that's why it's so important to get it clear, the font. Are you using grammar in the single bracket, a word, or the double parentheses? Carol, maybe I should just illustrate that, because this is an ultimate point between these two scripts. That's why I think it's important to get some signs out to the culture, to ourselves, to say don't conflate these two levels.
Yes, please. I don't know if you have some examples, but I imagine, you know, both types happen even within the religious and spiritual and theological circles about
yes.
which mind they're working with.
Yes, let me give an example. When Descartes, the great philosopher, he was deeply misunderstood. When he was in his meditations and he saw that everything in his ego box, ego script, ego life, ego stories, all the mathematics, could be doubted, because our beliefs are propositions that we maintain and the narrative that we speak. Descartes saw we could doubt it all. He could be deceived. And he was frightened. He stepped back and he stripped himself down of all of those words. And yet he found, I am. When he said, I am, I am. I am my thinking. It was a huge moment for humanity. But scholars and interpreters put him right back in the box as making a proposition, I think, therefore I am, and kept him in the box. But that Descartes I am is huge. It's the same I am when God said to Moses, when Moses was scared to take the laws, and God said, whom shall I say sent me? Ask Moses. God said, I am that I am. That's how the infinite script speaks. You are the script. That's what was frightening to Descartes when he woke up. He saw that he was the very utterance I am. There was no longer a difference. So when a runner is in the zone, I use it for my students in the laboratories of my classroom year after year, and I get some really, really fine athletes and musicians, and they understand zone talk when you're in the zone. A runner knows that she is a cross-country runner, and coach has been coaching her from an ego-based how to run and breathe and move her elbows and so forth and raise her knees. And then one day running around nature trail, two miles around the campus, she goes into this blissful running state where she is the running. She's no longer I am running, but running is happening. When you're doing yoga and you go into that high yogic space with the breath, and you are the prana, you are the breath. It's not the ego breathing, but breath is breathing you. That's the breath of Logos. So that the many, when jazz musicians are ego jazzing and it's dissonant and it's not working, but they get out of themselves and suddenly the music takes over, the double bracket musical space, and they're jazzing in a magical way in the zone. That's blissful. It's peak performance. We know those moments. Those would be examples of the two vocabularies. So if I say now, I want to be here now, which sums up all wisdom, and you're using the ego calendar and clock, and the now moment is an ego moment, it's not the same as a Zen moment, a yoga moment. This is why writers like Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now, really need this difference between, if you're speaking to an ego-based culture, they're going to use your clock, calendar, time, linear time, as their reference for now, the present, versus the past and the future. If you can cross into the double parentheses now, into double bracket time, that's amazing, because every moment of time encodes the entire field of time right now. So if you could be in that moment, which is all the wisdom, you open up to this boundless possibility.
That's eternal.
Exactly. That's the eternal now.
Yeah. That's interesting. You know, I want to go back. You mentioned the phrase "in the box," where they had to put Descartes back in the box, and the box is an important concept, I think, because, you know, we tend to put each other in it, or keep each other in it, or identify each other by the box
and ourselves.
I guess in general, people, is it fear? That so long as I know what you believe, then I can put you in that box. And that's not necessarily the double bracket sacred, even if people share with each other. What holds us back in this?
That's a great question. And, of course, our teachers had to address that. It's really complex, but let's simplify it if possible. When I say the box, just think of it as if you're watching the screen. You're watching TV, you're watching a movie, and there's a screen, and the information is outside of you on the screen. And you see the characters on the screen playing, and you're one of them, because that's where you use the ego script or the mono script. It's called objectification. You distance yourself and you look from the outside at the content. That's really what box is. So to put you in the box or myself in the box, if we use those name tags, simple naive identity, every name has a thing and that's its meaning, and you break from the connectivity and the flow, which is what the sin script is or the samsara script, that's really why it's so profound, because the condition of sin is using this script that tags everything with its name but breaks it off from its higher name source. And the whole journey of script is to upscript to the holistic script, where you say, oh my God, these words that I've been using have fallen into disgrace and broken. If I can heal my words and place them back in this integral space of a holistic meaning and gain that literacy or regain that literacy, that's where I'll see the connection across our world and our scripts and our worldviews and our religions and our scriptures and our disciplines. So the liberal arts, if we're alleging that liberal arts student who is understands the liberal arts but has been just trained in the box. I know physics over here, here's economics, here's fine arts, here's music, here's mathematics. Bam, you're a graduate now. You're liberally educated. No, you've been boxed in.
Yeah.
You've been packaged.
Yeah, well, there seems to be a meaning puzzle that's not there if it's all fragmented.
Exactly right. So it's at every side of our culture. So if we could imagine a dialogue, a real dialogue, a deep dialogue, Carol, in which our diverse religious scriptures can say, the language of Allah is absolutely unique and glorious. The language of the Judaic tradition of the Abraham and Isaac struggle and the whole great prophets and Moses, there's nothing like that. It's not in the Gita. It's not in Buddha script. It's not in Lao Tzu in China. They're all diverse. But my God, they're all expressing the infinite logos. And if we can get that, that's the code. If I can get that global decoder and see, I can see when Jesus said, when I was in prison, you visited me. When I was hungry, you fed me. And the disciple says, when did we do that? When you tended to the least of mine, you tended to me. That moment is very precisely scientifically expressing in an alternative font the same axiom of Buddha, that so all beings are interconnected. And therefore, when you tend to yourself, you tend to the other, because the other is within you. That law of love, to see, oh, that's what love is. We're interconnected so that I can't violate you. I can't objectify you. I can't put you in the box. And that's what our great moral teachers saw. If you box a person and yourself, you're doing profound violence. You're not treating a person as a sacred presence, but as an object, and yourself as well. So everything turns on this point.
Now, in what you describe as the perennial quest to decipher the universal code or infinite logos at the heart of Eastern and Western thought, would you say that the whatever must be universal must be similar? Or are there possible, I mean, if it's one universal code, that at the core of Eastern and Western thought we wind up sort of at the same place?
Great question again, and that's really the earlier remark about the logos is infinite and therefore has infinite diversity the infinite has infinite names, God has infinite names, and the field has infinite boundless possibilities, that's what it means, it really recognizes that to find a decoder, a global decoder, precisely allows us not to make the fatal mistake of reducing those diversity to any single bracket unity or one, but rather the opposite. In other words, take any person, a female, for example, who is a feminist liberation say a black person, an African-American, who's saying, that's my identity, an African-American, or I'm a Quaker.
Right.
Or you're much deeper than that. Those name tags, you know, may be useful in the everyday marketplace, but really, you, a human, you're way beyond that in your depth of diversity and uniqueness. So to get the global lens and the literacy of the I Thou script, to enter into the depth of that, the unity there is not a single bracket sameness. That's a fatal mistake.
Right.
The language of Allah is unique. The language of yoga is unique. The language of Buddha is different. Lao Tzu and the Qi and acupuncture is different than the Christ. And yet, the double bracket axioms of that, there still is a deep science of the logosphere. For example, all beings are connected. Everything is interconnected in flow, would emerge as a global axiom. So if Jesus speaks his download of that axiom, and Buddha speaks a different one, and Krishna in the yoga speaks a different one, you don't have to say they're saying the same thing in the old language. You can say more in a more sophisticated and finessed way that they are saying something in an absolutely unique, historically unique way, but it's still expressing profound global axioms. And the global axioms doesn't mean they're saying the same thing. It opens up the possibility for diversity.
Now, here's a question with all that we've discussed this in this hour, with the goal of the grammar of the universal code. What can we manifest if we achieve that globally?
Well, that's a huge question. It's a beautiful question. I mean, to me, working with the World Commission and the World Wisdom Council and the evolutionary leaders and the wide range of people I'm networking with and who are seeking to, as activists, to help bring a new higher consciousness literacy to the planet, because we finally are beginning to make the link between the mental processes we use and the state of our life. And once you make that link, you say, so what would a culture look like when people begin to gain this integral literacy and this higher script?
Yes, exactly.
You see? So that just to run through many possibilities, how would I be in my own inner life? Can I really handle diversity now? Can I be a Christian and also a scientist and also a civic American and do yoga and practice feng shui and go to my acupuncturist for integral healing without being busted up into many fragmented personae? Yes, it becomes possible now with a decoder. The double bracket code, if you can get that code, you realize now with this deeper literacy and rationality and competence that you can find profound interconnected links in diverse ways without reducing it to the old single bracket unity and therefore compromising and destroying it. You can celebrate it. So integral medicine. Suppose you want to go to your acupuncturist, but you want to take eye surgery with the allopathic scientific medicine, and you want to take the medication, that miracle drugs, really. But you can also be a Christian scientist with faith healing at the same time and practice your yoga as a technology of entering into this om space and being one with your breath, which would be healing. Those are the examples just in terms of your medical practice, whether as a patient or as a physician. Imagine democracy for a moment. What would America be like? Have we really achieved the American Revolution yet at this depth? Okay, we drove out the British colonial structure, but we kept the old lens.
Yeah.
And yet the civic space is fragmented. We don't have deep dialogue. So we, the people, are not finding the highest form of deep democracy together, where we can hold the power together in compassion for one another, celebrate our diversity, and tend to one another, the way Martin Luther King was envisioning, and is implanted and encoded within our constitutional vision. We have another example. Education. What would happen to education? But to follow your question, if we could become and learn the script of going deep into physics and mathematics and logic and music and athletics and still find the celebrate the unity and interconnectedness of that liberal arts font, to see that ratio and music and number and mathematics and logic profoundly linked in this logosphere, if we could decode and process those interconnections. And they're beginning to emerge. There are more and more imaginal people and scholars and citizens who are beginning to see and tap what is already within us, which is the axis. You said this earlier, that it seems to haunt us. And that's what's so exciting about these times. People are stirring. They're really ready to leave the old cave places and boxes and come out into the light and learn the script that we're meant to. That's already encoded within us.
Yes. Yes, we know that there is a progression going on and that it's necessary. We can feel that. It's intuitive, I believe. But like in the book Ishmael, for example, there was a suggestion that we stopped evolving personally and started focusing on technology, and we evolved our tools for a very long time, and that we've gotten to a point now where our technology is very well developed, and of course leading to conversations like this one. We've become global through our communications technology, for example, but that now our human, spiritual evolution needs to develop again.
Absolutely right.
To move forward.
And the way I speak in my writings and teachings is that when we realize that what we call technology in the single bracket itself, which are the things and the breakthroughs, whether it's a jet plane or the cell phone or the television,
yeah,
which are magnificent miracles, actually, because what we know is that no single bracket culture can ever do anything without the resource of the double bracket presence. We're tapping and downloading from the presence for all of our important breakthroughs in culture. That's simply one of the axioms we see. But what is the ultimate technology? It's not the stuff we make. It's a techne of consciousness, the technology of consciousness. What's that? The script, the mind-operating process that we're using. And if we're using an ego script, that technology has proven to be dysfunctional. It's a technology that breaks. And it's a technology because it makes our world and our culture and our religion and our life. We are making our life with our minds. We are as we mind. And therefore, if we can upgrade our technology of consciousness, we have a higher technology for life. And that's what our great teachers were trying to urge us to do, the primary technology, as you point out. And that's been in a terrible lag. But now we need it to survive.
Yes, yes. Now, we're coming to the end of the program. And before we close, I would just like to touch base on a couple of things. First of all, if people would like to learn more about your work and your books and projects, where can they go?
Could you have website
information?
I do, and there's quite a bit on it. It's www.awakeningmind.org. And there they can find references to my books, videos, radio interviews like this, and I hope to place this one on that website as well. It refers to my professorship at Haverford College. I was just honored with the Distinguished Chair in Global Philosophy at Haverford College 3 weeks ago after 43 years of teaching there. They can discover all of those things. I've been a TV host for 5 years in Philadelphia, and the show was called Global Lens, a double bracket, and I've interviewed many people in the global lens, so I'm in the same kind of enterprise as you are, Carol. You're doing a beautiful job with your radio station.
Oh, thank you. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the show today, Ashok. It's been an incredible, informative hour, and it's something we can go on, I'm sure, about for many more hours. But I just wanted to thank you so much for this conversation today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, and I thought your questions were very sensitively placed, and I felt very invited to share with you, and so thank you for having me.
Thank you again, and best of luck.
And all the best to you.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today on the Godspeed Institute. This show was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City.
engineered by Barry Dwyer and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous shows again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com, where you can also find my books on spirituality and a library of others. Join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed always on your journey.